Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. When legislators gather in Annapolis a week from today for the 437th session of the Maryland General Assembly, balancing the state's budget will top their work agenda. Millions of dollars in taxes that had been forecast are now not expected to materialize, so the state faces a $400 million budget gap. Senate President Mike Miller and House Speaker Michael Bush, both Democrats, have promised not to close the deficit with new taxes or fees. One potential solution? Hiring more state employees on time-limited contracts rather than as full-time workers. Governor Hogan will unveil his budget proposal in a couple of weeks. This will be the Republican governor's third legislative session facing the assembly dominated by Democrats. The governor kicked off the season's political discussion yesterday with a set of environmental proposals, including $41 million in incentives for renewable energy sources. The 90-day legislative session is also expected to consider paid sick leave, how Maryland draws its congressional and legislative districts, fracking, and much, much more. With me to preview the upcoming session of the General Assembly is Rachel Bay, WIPR State House reporter. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
And Brian Sears, Daily Record government reporter. Welcome.
Good morning.
Do you see an overarching theme to this session?
Money to pay for everything. It's really going to come down to the budget and how do we pay for the priorities that both the legislature says is important and the priorities which will be different in a lot of ways from a Republican governor. And so I think really in the end, it's going to be all about the Benjamins, as the kids would say.
All about the Benjamins. Okay. Well, before we get a little more into that, let's talk about legislation that the governor has vetoed, which the Democrats intend to override. Last year, the Assembly passed legislation to raise the proportion of electricity generated from renewable sources and put a surcharge on customers' electric bills to pay for investment in that technology. Governor Hogan said yesterday he considers the surcharge to be a multi-million dollar tax, and he's against it.
Back during the campaign, I was fighting against the rain tax, right? And I jokingly said that what are they going to think of next, the sunshine tax? This is actually a sunshine tax. It's charging people on their every month on their bill to force people to buy expensive solar and wind energy that we don't need this bill to pass.
Do you expect Governor Hogan to be as successful with the political label sunshine tax as he was with rain tax?
I think that's going to be difficult to tell in the course of a session. Those things are generally better played out during the course of elections. And so it'll be interesting. I mean, he's starting to add a lot of these labels. The sunshine tax is now the new rain tax. Those sound like tryouts for campaign slogans for a 2018 reelection.
So what is your expectation then in the near term about this veto of Governor Hogan's? Does it look like it's going to stand, or is the legislature likely to override it?
Well, the bill originally passed with veto-proof majorities in both the House and the Senate, and the leaders of both houses are at this point pretty confident that they will be able to override that veto. So, yes, it does look like it will be overridden.
And there's another snappy name that the governor has put onto another bill that he has dubbed the Roadkill Bill.
Yes.
What does the roadkill, what he calls the roadkill bill, what do the Democrats call it, and what would it do?
So the Democrats call it the, I believe it's Transportation Open.
I believe they call it the Transportation Transparency Act.
The bill effectively requires the Maryland Department of Transportation to come up with a scoring rubric for all transportation projects in the state going forward. So they would give scores to projects based on how well they advance specific state goals like improving the environment or, you know, increasing mobility in specific areas, improving the economy in certain regions. And the bill requires the Department of Transportation to prioritize projects that have higher scores over those projects that have lower scores. However, the bill does allow the department to choose lower scoring projects if they provide a written explanation, effectively saying why they've chosen those lower scoring projects. And so that's kind of the hang up on this bill, is the governor's administration says.
Let's hear how Governor Hogan discussed the bill yesterday.
We've said we are going to repeal that bill, that the bill has to be repealed. There's no question about that. So we're announcing the projects that need to be funded, that are the state's priorities, that are the local government's priorities. And if this idiotic bill was not overturned, then they would be killed. In fact, 66 of the top 73 projects would be killed. But that's not going to stop us from continuing to move forward with what we think is right for the state. And we believe that they are going to come to their senses and not destroy transportation in the state.
So, Rachel, as you said, the Democrats keep stressing that it would be possible to fund a lower-ranking bill as long as the governor gives a reason for doing it. Why has this become such a contentious issue?
It's hard to say. A lot of people have speculated that this bill stemmed from the outcry over the Red Lines cancellation in Baltimore or disappointment in other transit decision-making by the Hogan administration. So this bill would require that in the future, those kinds of decisions be explained in writing. So if they're canceling a transit project like that, they would have to give a written justification for why they're doing so. And it effectively comes down to a kind of a power struggle between the executive and the legislature. The executive claiming that this is the legislature trying to wrest power over transportation decisions in the state, and the legislature, backed by the Attorney General's office, by the way, saying that's not the case at all. This still leaves the decision-making power in the executive branch's hands.
Well, Brian Sears, one of the things that I'm a bit confused about, the governor talked about that 66 of the top 73 projects would be killed under this nefarious Democratic system. But there isn't enough money to fund all the projects anyway.
There's
this
never
is
enough
a question.
Money. I mean, in the coming year, we're talking about $917 million for transportation projects for local priorities, which is what we're talking about. I mean, the scoring is all based on what each county is asking the state to help them fund. And so we're talking in the current budget year, $917 million coming up. The need is always greater than the ability to pay for it. I don't think it's speculative to say that this stemmed from the issues related to the Red Line. For every time that leadership has told me this is not about the Red Line, sponsors and rank and file members of the legislature immediately talk about the Red Line, immediately talk about the Watkins Mill interchange in Montgomery County. This is also probably about the fact that there's a Republican governor making these decisions and sending money to rural counties, as opposed to some of the public transportation projects in urban areas. You do have a lot of that. And the fact of the matter is that this bill was written in part by a former member of the O'Malley cabinet. And this bill didn't surface during any time that O'Malley was in office. It came to light during a Republican second year in the governor's mansion. And so you can't not consider the possibility that there's politics in Maryland.
Listening between the lines of what you're saying, then I gather you expect this veto to be, well, it's already been overridden.
It has already been overridden.
So you expect this legislation to stay in place.
I do. I will lay out one possible sort of a scenario, and I wouldn't be willing to call this my stone cold lock of the session. But, you know, the governor is talking about a repeal of this. There are some legislators that may be getting tired of the dickering back and forth between them and the governor, and they may seek to make some changes to kind of put more oomph behind this and push it in a direction that they want to go. I could see a scenario under which, you know, we saw the repeal of the rain tax bill, which wasn't really a repeal at all, but the governor declared victory. But I like to tell people, if you take a look at the bill signing of that bill, you don't see people representing Maryland's county standing behind the governor. They're all environmentalists who loved the bill. So how much did it really repeal the so-called rain tax? I think you could see a scenario in which the legislature makes some changes that, you know, perhaps the governor finds a way to declare victory on, and the legislature can keep their bill and they'll declare victory as well. But if that happens, that's going to be legislative driven.
This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. I'm talking about what to expect from the 2017 General Assembly with Brian Sears, Daily Record government reporter, and Rachel Bay, WIPR State House reporter. The budget. Why is there a budget gap?
I think, and I'll put a little more of a point on it than Warren Deschenaux, the legislature's chief budget analyst, did. But when you have a state that increases its budget by 5% every year and the revenues are growing by 3.6% every year, revenues are going up in Maryland, but we're spending more than we're bringing in. So we don't have a revenue problem. We have a spending problem. I think that's what it is.
But why didn't they see this one coming?
I think it's instructive to go back to October when Warren Deschenaux met with the Joint Spending Affordability Committee and told them it was time for legislators to get real about the budget. And in part of that message, a lot of times what they were doing was year-to-year fixes with the idea that Maryland's economy would eventually recover. And so every year they kept looking for it to get better, thinking that it would get better because historically it always has gotten better. But there are economic indicators that are coming out of the comptroller's office that suggest that we're seeing a slower recovery than we've ever seen historically. And this may be an indicator that we're entering sort of a new normal here and that we're not going to see these gigantic recoveries that we used to see in economic downturns. And so I think really what this is sort of the clash between the optimistic outlook of, you know, we know we're eventually going to get better because we always have, and the realism now that this is the way that the economy looks for us right now.
So, Rachel Bay, if the president of the Senate, Mike Miller, and the speaker of the House, Michael Bush, have both said they're not looking to close the shortfall, the $400 million or so, with tax increases or fees, how are they talking about approaching this?
The first thing they'll tell you when you ask them that is that this is the governor's budget and that we have to wait until the governor puts forward the budget before we can start talking about how those gaps are going to be closed. It's really in Hogan's hands. But at the same time, they do say to expect programs to be cut in whole. They don't say which programs. They're very nonspecific at this point. It's too early to say which, but some programs are likely on the chopping block.
You have to remember that politically, it's probably not feasible for the legislature to look at tax increases given what we saw in the 2014 election. There's a realization, a very real realization at the political level that you just can't do that, especially under a governor who has promised no new taxes and will likely use that any attempt to do that as a stick to beat Democrats over the head with in 2018.
Well, Governor Hogan's response sounded a bit actually like what you said a minute ago, Brian, which is that this is a problem with mandates that the legislature keeps formulas, it keeps writing into spending laws, not one-off appropriations for a given year, but it's built-in growth in programs. Do you, either of you, expect this would be a year where that gets addressed?
That's definitely something the governor's administration has said is a priority. They made it a priority last year, and at a conference last month, one of Governor Hogan's advisors said that that's still a priority for him. So it's definitely going to come up. It didn't get very far last year, though, so there's no real expectation that it's going to get a lot further this year.
Delegate Maggie McIntosh, chairman of the Appropriations Committee, told me in a story that we ran on Tuesday that she does believe that the state has to look at the spending side of the ledger. But she points out very quickly that there is some budget moves that can be made, including one that's essentially a bill that changes the spending that we refer to affectionately as the BRFA, which is not super sexy sounding, but it does some really important stuff in which they can change the mandates a little bit. And so, you know, in our conversation, she sort of said, you know, we can make these changes, and so where's the mandates? You know, in the end, she believes they have some flexibility.
Okay, we have to take a quick break here. This is On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. We're looking ahead to this year's legislative session. And when we come back, I want to ask how Maryland's legislature might respond to some initiatives from the Trump administration in Washington. Stay with us. Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. I'm speaking with WIPR Statehouse reporter Rachel Bay and Brian Sears, the Daily Record's government reporter, ahead of this year's legislative session, which begins a week from today. Even though Governor Hogan did not endorse Donald Trump, the governor will attend the Trump inauguration January 20th. Hogan also told reporters this.
I spent quite a bit of time talking with the vice president about one of their top priorities is to invest a lot more money in infrastructure. And if we do that, that will help us here in Maryland get many of the projects that's been a primary focus of mine. We've put more money into transportation infrastructure than has ever been done in Maryland. They're talking about doing the same thing at the federal level, which has been lacking. And if that happens, it'll create a lot of opportunities for us here in Maryland.
Let's pick up on the infrastructure question. President-elect Trump has talked about tax credits for public-private partnerships. What are the implications for the Purple Line or for any of the projects in Maryland, the Harry Nice Bridge replacement or a third span over the Chesapeake Bay? Will any of these be affected?
Well, the Harry Nice Bridge is going to be done solely by the state. with the legal action against the Purple Line, it's anyone's guess at this point. Until we see an actual plan at the federal level, you don't know how the tax credits might work in a P3. One of the bigger issues, though, that the governor and Transportation Secretary Pete Ron are looking for is this idea that Trump has floated about repatriating millions of dollars, billions of dollars in overseas corporate money. This sounds a lot like the plan that Representative John Delaney from Western Maryland has been talking about. And the governor has specifically mentioned that if that happens, you know, there would be possibly money to replace the Solomon's Bridge and, you know, the Thomas Johnson Bridge in Southern Maryland, which is another bridge that desperately needs to be replaced and the people who live down there are constantly complaining about. That's one of those things, if Trump can do it, Pete Ron has called that pie in the sky, but I think they sort of also hope that if that happens, that there would be money to do sort of these larger projects like replacing the Thomas Johnson Bridge and who knows what that study on the third span of the Bay Bridge is going to look like.
So it could have some impact. We could be seeing...
Theoretically, I mean, but again, you know, until you actually see a plan and a plan gets passed and you see the money, it's all just sort of wishful thinking at this point. But it sounds nice, and Maryland could use the money.
Well, the first milestone I think everyone expects from the new Republican era in Washington is a repeal of Obamacare. And more it seems like we're looking at a repeal right now and replacement at some point in the future. Obamacare in Maryland was heavily an expansion of Medicaid and increasing the number of Marylanders who were eligible for Medicaid with very generous federal matches, or the feds picking up a big part of the expense of those newly insured Maryland families. What do you think is going to happen? And is the legislature looking at somehow protecting Marylanders from a repeal of Obamacare?
Legislators in both parties have spoken, again, in kind of vague terms about trying to buffer the impact of any changes to the Affordable Care Act. But since we don't know what the repeal and replace concept will look like specifically, the legislators don't know how they're going to be able to buffer Marylanders from feeling the impact of that. But you have heard it from both Republicans and Democrats in the General Assembly.
Well, I mean, for example, I remember that Maryland had a law on the books before the federal Affordable Care Act was passed. Maryland was already requiring insurers to keep young people on their parents' health insurance up to age 25. Then Obamacare made that age 26. Is someone talking about trying to get some of those things lined up?
I don't think we've heard those yet because, again, we haven't seen the federal legislation. So that'll largely be a reaction to what they do at the federal level, which we may not see in this current session. One of the things that is going to get talked about, though, is the potential loss of billions of dollars in Medicaid waiver money. I mean, this is a complicated process that probably a handful of people, including Pete Hammond, who just departed the state legislature for the Pew administration, really sort of understood. And so there are going to be a lot of legislators who are going to be very concerned about that. That could have tremendous impacts on the state budget. The expansion of Medicaid, even if the law is allowed to stand, theoretically could have tremendous impacts. The expansion of Medicaid in Maryland under ACA, if the federal government were to start to limit or reduce those payments to the state would have to make up that money or start cutting the number of people who are on Medicaid. And there's some numbers out there. The last time I heard this talked about was about a year ago, but there were some numbers floated that at some point, you know, some point in the very near future, the amount of money being spent on Medicaid could go up to about one out of every $3 in the general fund budget. I mean, that's more money than we spend on education in Maryland.
Wow, that's really something that we need to keep an eye on. This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast, speaking with government reporters Rachel Bay of WIPR and Brian Sears of The Daily Record about the upcoming session of the Maryland General Assembly. It begins a week from today. One of the things I'm curious about is Governor Hogan's executive order requiring schools systems not to start until after Labor Day. At the time the governor announced that, I remember Senator Paul Pinsky of Prince George's, who I think chairs the Education Committee, a subcommittee in the Senate, talking about legislation to reverse that executive order. Is anyone talking about that? Because it sounds like the governor's executive order is pretty popular.
It is pretty popular, and I think that the concern is that we've seen two polls from Goucher College that have suggested that, you know, that this is almost as popular as Governor Larry Hogan's approval ratings, and I think that there's a concern that, you know, the legislature could be made to be seen as the Grinch that stole Labor Day.
Paid sick leave. That's been an issue for several years in the legislature. Where does it stand? What's likely to happen?
So Governor Hogan came out with his own version of the paid sick leave concept. His proposal would require businesses with at least 50 workers to provide paid sick leave and would offer tax incentives to smaller businesses if they do the same. The proposal that's been floating around for this would be the fifth year if it comes back is quite a bit more expansive. The most recent version, the version that passed the House of Delegates last year, required businesses with 15 employees to provide paid sick leave.
The governor's proposal is aimed at bigger businesses.
Right. So the governor's proposal really seemed to be kind of a compromise measure, kind of anticipating that some version of sick leave would pass, but he pitched it as a more business-friendly version of the paid sick leave bill. So probably what we're going to see is some sort of battling of these two versions of sick leave in the General Assembly.
But this may be the year that something actually passes both houses.
With proposals from both parties at this point, I'd say that's fairly likely.
One of the things that's also missing from the legislative proposal is the concept of preemption. You have counties like Montgomery County and other jurisdictions who are considering, as they did with minimum wage bills, considering their own versions of paid sick leave. And there are businesses that would like to see a preemption clause that would forbid counties from enacting their own paid sick leave bills. And that's something that's in the governor's proposal that's not currently in the legislative proposal. It doesn't sound to me like the governor's proposal is going to go very far, given the conversations that I've had with leaders on the legislative bill.
Very quickly, before we have to leave, bail reform, is something going to go on with that in the legislature this year?
I think that the Court of Appeals and what they're going to do on Thursday and looking at their rule changes that are going to start requiring judges to not impose bail as a way of just de facto keeping people in jail is going to force the hand on the legislature. Right now, the only plan on the table is this discussion about a risk assessment tool, which Joe Valerio, the chairman of the Judiciary Committee in the House, and Bobby Zirkin, who's the chairman of JPR, Judicial Proceedings Committee, in the Senate, both oppose. And Bobby Zirkin speaks of it in sort of non-glowing terms and refers to it as R2-D2 bail.
Because it's untouched by human hands?
Yeah, essentially because it's done through a computer assessment and it's meant to sort of make it more objective. But the bail lobby is very powerful, maybe the first or second most powerful lobby in the state of Maryland. And there are a lot of state's attorneys that, you know, like Scott Schellenberger in Baltimore County, who think that this is an attempt to fix a system that's not broken.
Okay, a lot that you have identified for us and a lot more we could have talked about. I really appreciate you both giving us this overview. Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
WIPR State House reporter Rachel Bay and Brian Sears, government reporter for The Daily Record. We're going to be following your stories throughout the session. This is On the Record. I'm Sheila Cass. Thanks for listening. Come back tomorrow.